Hello everyone, good afternoon, and welcome to an episode of Everyday Black History. I'd like to welcome you all. I know it's been quite a long time, a few months actually, since we last did an episode. I think the last episode I did was back in April. Yeah, April 19th, and man, wow. I mean, 3 months, like now, that was in the springtime, now we're well into the summertime, and you know, summer's going by pretty fast. But you know, had to take some time off, you know, personal things, you know, life, you know, life gets in the way. You gotta take time out from the extracurricular activities such as podcasts sometimes when you have to take care of, you know, obligations. But you know, I'm back now and I'm happy to be back. I missed, you know, talking about Black history on this platform with you all. So I'm definitely happy to be back and looking forward to getting back into putting out regular content. I have, you know, content that I'm looking forward to sharing, as well as talking about history, Black history and the importance of it. And people who are not well known through history or forgotten about through history, you know, those are the people we're going to talk about and highlight, as we always do on Everyday Black History. But 3 months, yeah, I think this is the longest I've ever gone without doing an episode. Because, you know, sometimes you take breaks here and there, but I think this was the longest I've gone without doing an episode, and I missed you all. So I'm happy to be back and doing some new episodes. And today we're going to be talking about a civil rights leader and who just passed yesterday, a brother by the name of Robert Parris Moses, Robert P. Moses, or mostly known as Bob Moses. He was a civil rights activist and he passed away yesterday, July 25th, at the age of 86. And although he's not as well known as Martin Luther King or, you know, other civil rights activists who were contemporaries of his, the work that he did in civil rights, and not just for civil rights, but as a teacher and teaching minority kids the importance of math and algebra, like he did a lot of important work for the community and not throughout the country, in New York and Mississippi. You know, his work carried throughout America. So we just wanted to talk about him and highlight him, his work, his life, and what his legacy means to Black history. So Robin Moses, he was an educator, a civil rights activist, and he was known for his work as a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which, you know, many people, anybody who knows anything about civil rights, especially during the 60s, you know those initials, SNCC. But he worked a lot with voter education and registration in the state of Mississippi during civil rights. And you know, if you know anything about the state of Mississippi, Mississippi is one of those just completely racist, you know, states, especially during civil rights. I mean, it was, I mean, we don't even have to go into the history of Mississippi's racism towards and prejudice towards Black people, Black men and women. I mean, that's a whole other episode to itself, and we don't want to talk about anything negative. We want to talk about positive. So, but he went down to Mississippi to get Black Americans registered to vote, and he also co-founded the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. He was a graduate of Hamilton College as well as Harvard University, and he developed later on in his career what was known as the Algebra Project in the United States. And, you know, we'll get into that a little bit more about the Algebra Project and what that meant. And he received many awards, honorary doctorates from several colleges. He received the MacArthur Fellowship for his work. And, you know, yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about his life today. So he was born January 26, 1935. In Harlem, New York, and he came from humble beginnings. His dad was a janitor, Gregory Moses, and his mom, Lewis Moses, was a homemaker. And he had, he had siblings as well that grew up in the Harlem River houses. But he was, it was said that he was a frequent at the public library. And, you know, whenever you see children who like to go to the library, you know, that you kind of already know that they are going to be a studious person. Because most children, you know, when you're young, you want to play games, you want to watch TV, you're not really thinking about going to the library. But I did go to school who was with children who was like that, and they did end up becoming very smart, studious people, you know, professional people. And, you know, the same is true with Bob Moses. He graduated from Stuyvesant High School in 1952, and he received his bachelor's from Hamilton College in 1956. He majored in philosophy and French, and he also played basketball while he was in college at Hamilton. In 1957, he earned his master's in philosophy at Harvard University and was working toward his PhD when his parents got sick, so he had to move back to New York City to help take care of them. But while he was here, when he came back home, he taught in the Bronx. And while he was teaching in the Bronx, he became a tutor to a well-known doo-wop singer by the name of Frankie Lyman. Now, if you're not familiar with the name Frankie Lyman, maybe you can check out that movie Why Do Fools Fall in Love with Lorenz Tate, and Halle Berry's in it, Lila Vachon, and Vivica Fox. Well, that's who it talks about. Frankie Lyman. Lorenz Tate played Frankie Lyman. He was a young doo-wop singer in the 1950s, and he was part of this group called the Teenagers. So, you know, back then, whenever you were young and you were a singer, they paid tutors to come and tutor you while you were on the road. And so Bob Moses was Frankie Lyman's tutor. And he credited his experience visiting black sections of the numerous towns that the doo-wop group was performing in for his recognition of the emergence of a urban black culture that was scattered across America. And so, you know, during that time and because of that exposure and seeing all that, it led to him becoming one of the influential black leaders of the civil rights struggle. And he had a vision of grassroots and community-based leadership. He was different from Martin Luther King. You know, they had different approaches, but Martin Luther King did respect his contributions to the movement. And he referred to him as being inspiring and his ideas that he had inspiring. And so he initiated and organized voter registration drives in the South, sit-ins, and freedom schools for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And in the 1960s, when, you know, during the civil rights period, he became the field secretary of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And in 1960, and he traveled to Mississippi to try and register black voters. And he went to the counties where they were majority black. And even though a lot of people left during the Great Migration in the first half of the century, they had those communities were still heavily populated with black Americans who were closed out of the political process since 1890. Since 1890, there were laws put into place to stop black Americans from voting in Mississippi. And he pushed for the SNCC to engage in a tactical nonviolence. And he discussed this with, you know, different people in the civil rights movement. White Democrats during this time had disenfranchised Mississippi blacks, black voters in the 1890 Constitution, where they brought about poll taxes and residency requirements, literacy tests that were subjective to, you know, that was subjective to them, you know, like they brought about these tests, these bias tests that, you know, of course, a black person is not going to be able to pass because, you know, they didn't know the history or whatever it was that they were asking on these tests. It's like if you were to reverse it and create a literacy test for white folks and put something there, put things there about black history, they're not going to know because they didn't study black history. They don't know anything about black history. So that's what was done to black Americans in Mississippi. They brought about these tests that was biased towards the black voters and all these barriers that prevented them from voting. So it was nearly impossible for black Americans in Mississippi to register and vote. And after decades of violence and repression under Jim Crow by the 60s, you know, most black Americans that lived in those counties didn't even bother. They didn't even try to register. There was only one black American among 5,500 in one county that was registered to vote in 1965. Only one. So, you know, Bob Moses, you know, he faced, you know, threats of violence, to intimidation. It was relentless. He was beaten, he was arrested, and he was the first black American to challenge white violence and filed assault charges against his attackers. But of course, the all-white jury acquitted his attacker, and the judge told him that he couldn't protect them. He actually provided him an escort to the county line, and that was all he did for him. He had no protection while he was there, just trying to get people to vote. In September of 1961, a white state legislator by the name of E.H. Hurst killed a brother by the name of Herbert Lee. And Herbert Lee worked with Bob Moses. He was a local farmer in Liberty, Mississippi. And he had been a, he was trying to register black people, black Americans in those counties to vote as well. He owned his own business. He was a successful a businessman. He owned a farm, and he did very well for himself, owned his land and everything. Had a big family. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Herbert Lee had, I think, 9 children. Yeah, he had 9 children, and he built a dairy and a cotton farm into a very successful business where he was able to support his large family. So a man with 9 children gunned down by a white state legislator in full view of witnesses, all because he was just, once again, trying to get black men and women in these counties in Mississippi to vote. He did it. The white state legislator killed him in front of over a dozen witnesses, and he was cleared, claiming self-defense. The courtroom was even filled with armed white men, you know, on the day that this legislator, E.H. Hurst, got off. There was one witness, a man by the name of Lewis Allen, who was another black man who was a farmer as well. And he was intimidated to state that it was in self-defense. So he was a logger. You know, he had his own logging business, and he was able to buy his own land. He did well for himself as well. And he was there when this murder happened. And so in order for them to get him to comply, they boycotted his business. They harassed him for discussing the Lee murder with federal officials. And soon, a few years after that 1961 murder of Herbert Lee, Lewis Allen himself was murdered in early 1964 by a sheriff who was a member of the KKK. So because he had discussed the Herbert Lee murder with federal officials, these federal officials wouldn't even offer him protection. He went and told them what he knew, but he asked for protection. They wouldn't even offer him protection. So he was leaving to, you know, because he feared for his life with his family. And the night before he left was when he was unfortunately killed by the sheriff in the town. So this is what, you know, was going on. And, you know, Bob Moses was around all this in Mississippi trying to, and like when you think about it, he was just trying to get people to vote. That's all they all were trying to do, was just get people to vote. And there was so much, such a violent reaction to that, you know, people ended up dead. And there's more, as you know, the Mississippi burning situation in 1964, where the 2 Jewish men, as well as the 1 black man, were all killed in Mississippi for, you know, going there for civil rights. That's well known. And you can imagine how scary it was for the volunteers who were there in Mississippi to help, you know, to get these black men and women registered to vote. And so when that happened, you know, Bob Moses and the other leaders got their volunteers together. And they told him, they was like, you know, this is what the struggle is. You know, no one will be mad at you if you left because, you know, understandably, this is a scary situation. So no one will be mad at you or think anything less of you if you left. But this is what the struggle is. You know, unfortunately, it can be life or death. And the sad thing was that a lot of volunteers that were there during this case with the Mississippi burning, with the two Jewish men, Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner, as well as James Chaney, who was the black man of the group who was also found dead. It got a lot of press, but it mostly got press because the two of the victims were white Northerners. The two Jewish men were from, I can't remember exactly where they were from, but I know they were from up north, and they came down south because of the civil rights movement. And so, you know, during this time, it was hard for the volunteers to even, you know, do this nonviolently and even work with some of their white counterparts. So it was a lot of tension. And you can imagine, I mean, you can imagine being in Mississippi in 1964, you're a black man or woman, and you see all this hate and all this murder going on around you. And now you have to be nonviolent, and now you have to work with, you know, white people who you see and you just automatically think of some of the racist, you know, Southerners in Mississippi, you know, so you can imagine the kind of tension that was there. But, you know, Bob Moses was able to get everybody together, and none of them left. You know, none of them left. They all stayed, and they all, you know, continued to do their work. Now, Bob Moses was instrumental in organizing the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and that was a group that challenged the all-white regular Democratic Party. He challenged the delegates from the state at the party's 1964 convention. Now, the Democratic regulars for decades had excluded black Americans from the political process in Mississippi. So the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party wanted their elected delegates seated at the convention. This made national media as well. And it highlighted the civil rights struggle in the state of Mississippi. One of the many things during this time that highlighted that. And the president at the time, Lyndon Johnson, and the Democratic leadership prevented any of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegation from voting in the convention, giving those seats that should have went to them to the Jim Crow regulars, who were the same people who were disenfranchising black voters. So, you know, Moses and the rest of the SNCC activists were, of course, disillusioned by this decision. How could you not be? And he also was disturbed by the liberal Democrats who, you know, pretended to be friends, but, you know, they pretty much undermined the grassroots movement that he was starting with the SNCC. You know, so it's that thing of, you know, in public, yeah, we support you, but in private, they're doing everything to prevent the movement from moving forward. So, you know, Moses kind of, you know, backed away for a little bit during that time because he said too many people were leaning on him and using him as a crutch. So, you know, he kind of backed away a little bit, and he participated in other campaigns like against the Vietnam War during the time. And he spoke at anti-war demonstrations, and, you know, he continued to be an activist, you know, and fight for different causes. He actually got to a point where he went to Africa, and he was in Africa for a little while. And following that trip, when he came back home, he came to believe that blacks must work independently of whites. And by 1966, he had cut off all relationship with all relationships with whites, even those who were former SNCC activists, because he was dedicated at that point into, you know, getting black people to work together for, you know, our own independence. But he, they actually tried to draft him to the war, Vietnam, even though he was 5 years too old for the age cutoff. So, he suspected that it was government agents who were trying to get him, sent to Vietnam. So him and his wife moved to Tanzania, And he lived there for 8 years and had three of their four children there. And he worked there as a teacher. And he returned to the United States in the mid-70s and went to Harvard doing graduate work in the philosophy of mathematics. And he taught math in public school in Massachusetts. And this was when he got into his next project. Now, in 1982, he received the MacArthur Fellowship. And so he used that award to create what he called, or what was known as, the Algebra Project. Now, the Algebra Project was devoted to improving minority education in math. And he started it in his daughter's classroom when he was teaching in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in a public school. And then he also taught math in Jackson, Mississippi, at a high school there. And he used the high school in Jackson, Mississippi, as a laboratory school for developing methods and approaches to the Algebra Project. And he enlisted the support of parents and the community in the project, which helped it to grow. And he expanded the Algebra Project from teaching math in one school to supporting to teaching it into over 200 schools across the country by the late 1990s. And, the Algebra Project's unique approach to school reform was revolutionary at the time, because it developed models that are sustainable and focused on the students. And so by him getting the community involved, the local community involved, that's how it helped to, that's how it was so successful. Not only did it help it to grow, but it also, the community got involved with their children, parents involved their children to help their children get better at math and at algebra. The Black community is historically an underserved population. So, you know, this was definitely helpful in spreading his movement. And it was used, the Algebra Project was used to change attitudes of our society that routinely promote the exclusion and regression of minorities. So the Algebra Project would take the students who scored the lowest on the state math test and prepare them for college level math by the end of high school. And this was done by doubling up on math courses for the 4 years of high school. And the Algebra Project was based in research and development, school development, and community insight development. So he created this, and it was definitely successful, and it was amazing what he was able to do. And then, you know, by getting the community involved, it continued to grow, and he received awards for his work with the Algebra Project, the National Science Foundation, to improve the development of materials for algebra. He worked to develop the Algebra Project to provide culturally sensitive, context-based material for the students. And as mentioned, it was something that was used and that was successful, that grew to over 200 schools throughout the country. His work, you know, has helped a lot in the community, and he was dedicated to that. 55% of the students that followed the Algebra Project's curriculum passed the state exam on their first attempt, compared with 40% of students following the regular curriculum. So more students who followed the Algebra Project curriculum scored higher on standardized tests and continued to more advanced math classes than their schoolmates who followed the standard curriculum. So naturally, that success is going to help it to grow. And it did continue to grow. And by them being prepared on that level through the Algebra Project, they could meet requirements for college admission and future entry-level good jobs. So not only did he help more people go to college, but he also helped more people to get good employment. You know, during those years, you didn't necessarily have to have a college degree. You know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Well, the Algebra Project started in the 80s. So in like the 80s and in the 90s, it wasn't necessary like it is now for you to have a college degree. If you had, you know, this kind of training, you could leave high school and get a really good job. Now, of course, if you had a degree, you can get more money. But you were prepared to go out into the workforce and get a good job. So that community work has helped, you know, generations of people to succeed, you know, the Algebra Project. So as mentioned, you know, Dr. He did end up receiving his doctorate. So, you know, Dr. Moses, he continued to work and do that. He taught school and continued teaching school in Mississippi and even in Miami, Florida. He was a visiting scholar at Princeton University, where he taught African American studies. And, you know, he had works, you know, books that he wrote. One, Radical Equations, Civil Rights from Mississippi to the Algebra Project. And he was also the co-editor of Quality Education as a Constitutional Right, Creating a Grassroots Movement to Transform Public Schools. So, you know, that brother, man, he did a lot. He did a lot. And, you know, when you go over his life, you appreciate what he did, you know, for the community, both during civil rights as well as, you know, through his work in the Algebra Project. As mentioned, he got, you know, MacArthur Fellowship. He got his doctorate from Hamilton College. He received a few honorary doctorate degrees from Harvard, Ohio State, and the University of Missouri. You know, extremely educated brother who did a lot for the community through his work. And so we just wanted to salute Dr. Bob Moses and give him a rest in peace shout out. He passed away yesterday at 86. And we just wanted to talk about his work and his life and what it meant to Black history and Black culture. So that concludes this episode of Everyday Black History. It was, as mentioned earlier, it was great to be able to come back and do another episode. And we will be coming with more content. On Friday, I'll be releasing an interview that was conducted. So we'll be doing more interviews as well. So stay tuned for that. And so, yeah, just stay tuned for the next episode, as there'll be more Black history coming to you. You all enjoy the rest of your week. Hope you had a good start to this week, as it's Monday. Hopefully you'll have a productive week. And before you know it, Friday will be here. As mentioned, we'll be releasing more material, and the weekend is here. So enjoy the rest of your night and stay tuned for the next episode.